Well, Friday's not guilty verdict for Kyle Rittenhouse, who killed two men during a protest in Kenosha, Wisconsin, turned up the heat on a roiling debate about self-defense in this country. Samuel Buell is a professor of law at Duke University. Professor, we heard a lot in the Rittenhouse trial about how an initial aggressor loses the right to self-defense. Now, the jury obviously didn't see Rittenhouse as the initial aggressor. They agreed with his claim of self-defense. That was head-scratching for people who think someone arriving with a military-style weapon to a public gathering is the initial aggressor. Your thoughts?
Yeah, so my thoughts on this are that we need a lot more thinking about it. Now, this is a very old concept in self-defense law. It's been around for hundreds of years, and it seemed to have functioned reasonably well. But in the world that we live in now, with the proliferation of firearms, and particularly sophisticated, high-powered firearms, this question of who is the provoker obviously becomes pivotal, and a jury isn't going to be told by the judge specifically how to work that out. So, one could look at this and say, well, somebody who comes to a heated confrontation with a very menacing-looking weapon is engaged in provocative behavior. But if the legal regime that applies to guns says that that's a lawful thing to do, then it's difficult, particularly when the prosecutor bears the burden beyond a reasonable doubt, to persuade a jury that that actually was the provocation. And then once he's there with the gun, somebody reacts to that. Now a jury has a basis to find that that's the provocation, which was his defense. Yeah. And really, this just becomes a question of jury verdicts when it should be a question of rules of the road.
Well, we're hearing this is something called a gun quatrain. Someone displays a gun in public. That's step number one. That frightens other people who think maybe he's a shooter. I'm going to be the hero here and stop him. And in the case of one person he shot, Rittenhouse said the person touched his gun, making them the aggressor. Others might say he tried to get the gun away from a shooter. But then you come to number three. The shooter now thinks, oh, somebody's trying to touch my gun. I'm afraid. Number four, he shoots and claims self-defense because he was afraid.
And you can see a terrible sort of vicious cycle. The more that this is sort of confrontation is happening, and the more that people see self-defense being raised and sometimes succeeding, the more people might reasonably think, well, I need to have a gun in that situation, or I need to be the person who moves first. And we have a situation where private violence is potentially escalating, when the whole purpose and idea behind self-defense law, going back to before the Constitution, was that it is a very, very narrow exception to the idea that the state has a monopoly on keeping the peace. And instead, we seem to have a conversation here that's moving towards the idea that it's private force first. It's quite troubling.
Well, a couple of things. You say people might say, hey, I need a gun too, if you're going to claim self-defense after you shoot someone. Someone might also say, I'm not going to try to stop that shooter, let's say with my skateboard, because then they can claim I'm attacking them. But you mentioned states. And isn't the difficulty that each state views this differently? I mean, in Wisconsin, you can carry a gun openly, but in some states, just that would, carrying a gun like that openly would make that person the aggressor. But include in this consideration stand your ground laws. You know, some states say, you have a duty to retreat before violence. Others say you don't have to. You can stand your ground.
Yeah, well, the retreat rules have always been a very essential part of self-defense law in terms of disciplining this question of whether the use of the deadly force is actually necessary. And I worry almost more than about how those laws are written. I worry about how people interpret those laws, that they somehow view this as, well, what's really going on is we've got a license to go around and kind of act like the private police and shoot people who resist, which is really not the concept of self-defense law or even these very broadened stand your ground laws.
What about citizens' arrest laws? And this is being considered because of the three white men accused of killing black jogger Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. They said at times they were making a citizen's arrest, but they never told police they were doing that. The law requires a citizen to have witnessed a crime before that citizen's arrest. Last week in testimony, one of the accused said, well, he hadn't actually seen a crime being committed. What are you watching here?
Well, I think, this is an area where we've got to have a very serious debate about legislative changes, at least in certain states. People should understand that these so-called citizens' arrest laws are actually very old in the law, and they have some horrible legacies that have to do with fugitive slaves and the like. But they also stem from a period of time when we didn't have professionalized police in this country, and there was much more of an idea about the citizen role in keeping the peace. We live in a very different world now, and I know that Georgia took a look at its law after the Arbery case, and I think we may see that happening in other states as well. Again, self-defense should be the last resort. Private use of deadly force should be a last resort. And we certainly don't want a situation where the message is out there, hey, you're free to take your guns, go around, and act as if you're a police officer. I mean, we saw this in the Trayvon Martin case as well. It's a very troubling trend.
Samuel Buell, professor at Duke University Law School, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.